Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and there's a lot of Trump-related economic news right now. The repeal of parts of the Dodd-Frank law passed by Congress after the financial crisis 10 years ago to reduce the risk of another huge taxpayer bailout of the banks and the impact on the private sector economy as well. The appointment of cable TV host and one-time Reagan budget official Larry Kudlow to replace Gary Cohn as the president's chief economics advisor. Trump claiming to the Prime Minister of Canada that we have a trade deficit with them without knowing whether that was true. The U.S. Trade Representative's office says it's false. But of course, Trump is doubling down, insisting once again that a false statement of his was true. And a report in the Times today that before the dust has settled on the steel and aluminum tariffs plan, that he's preparing more sweeping tariffs on tens of billions of dollars of products we import from China. Now, Crane's New York Business reports that steel prices are already rising for construction projects here in the city from just the anticipation of the steel tariffs taking effect. And apparently, according to the Times, more sweeping tariffs are in the offing. So with me to explain some of these developments and what they might mean for our wallets is Politico Pro's chief economics correspondent, Ben White. He's the author of the Morning Money column covering the nexus of finance and public policy. Ben, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC today.
Brian, thanks so much for having me, a longtime fan.
So the Senate on Wednesday passed the biggest loosening of financial regulations since the financial crisis a decade ago. President Trump, who loves big numbers, has promised to do a big number on Dodd-Frank. What sort of rollbacks are we looking at?
Right. Well, it's passed the Senate. It's not quite clear that it's going to get through the House and to the president's desk, but it does have some significant rollbacks of financial regulations, particularly on banks with assets of between $50 billion and $250 billion. So that's your mid-sized banks, your regional banks, not the big Wall Street behemoths, but sizable banks. And they would be subject to less scrutiny from the Federal Reserve. They wouldn't have to go through the stress tests that happen right now. So that's the biggest piece of it. Then you also have reduced regulations on smaller community banks and credit unions. That's aimed at getting more of those things to start up that serve rural America and smaller communities. So it's not at all a total rollback of the Dodd-Frank law, but big changes in here.
And proponents of the measure argue that rollbacks would provide long-awaited relief to thousands of community banks, as you say, and dozens of regional lenders. I believe that Barney Frank, the former Congressman Frank and Dodd-Frank, has endorsed that idea. But the bill also raises the threshold at which banks are considered too big to fail. So the trigger was set at $50 billion in assets. Now it's bumped up to $250 billion in assets. Is that a too big to fail bank?
Well, you know, it could be. It's hard to say in the abstract whether, you know, a bank like SunTrust or one of the others that's in that window could be too big to fail. The argument of proponents is that they're really not, that the economy could swallow a failure of one of those banks or even a couple of those banks that would be not the same as, say, J.P. Morgan and yeah. Citigroup and Morgan Stanley all failing. But, you know, these are large institutions, and if multiple of them failed at the same time, we would be in trouble. So that's why you see people like Elizabeth Warren saying this is a stealth rollback of important regulations.
And by the term too big to fail, which was in such common use 10 years ago, but maybe a lot of people don't know what it means now, and I guess you were getting at it a little bit there, if a bank is so big in its assets and has so many tentacles into so many corners of the private sector that one big bank goes down, you mentioned J.P. Morgan Chase, maybe Citibank, some others like that the harm to regular Americans would be so bad that it's in the government's interest to bail it out and not let it fail, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's what happened in the bailouts in the 2008-2009 financial crisis, the assumption was that the knock-on effects to the rest of the economy would be too great, not just for individual consumers who have accounts at these banks. I mean, those are backed up by the FDIC, but these are banks that bankroll a lot of the nation's largest companies, that have loans out to a lot of the largest companies, obviously have huge stock market value, and all of that collapsing would be dangerous to the economy. So that's what too big to fail essentially meant. And Dodd-Frank was meant to eliminate the idea of too big to fail, to set up a bankruptcy process where these things could be resolved. But, as of this moment, there are still clearly too big to fail banks. Now, the question with this deregulation is, are we setting up another situation in which you have a bunch of mid-sized banks who now could be too big to fail and will be not subject to the same kind of regulation? So we won't know exactly what they're doing and what they have on their balance sheet and whether they're taking risks that could be dangerous.
How do you see the divide in the Democratic Party on this? Since this bill passed 67-31 in the Senate, it had some Democrats voting for it. And we had, for example, Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts and Sherrod Brown from Ohio leading the vehement opposition to the bill, while other senators from other states who were Democrats were voting for it. Here's 28 seconds of Senator Warren.
This bill says, let's let those 25 banks be regulated just, like they were tiny little community banks. I got to tell you, a quarter of a $1 trillion bank is not a community bank. So what's the consequence of doing that, plus other changes that help the remaining banks? The answer is it puts us at greater risk that there will be another taxpayer bailout.
So if Elizabeth Warren was leading the Democratic opposition to this bill in the Senate, who was leading the Democratic support?
Well, Mark Warner from Virginia is one. You've got Heidi Heitkamp, John Tester. What you'll see is a lot of the Democrats who are in support of this come from red states that Trump won, not in the case of Virginia, but some of the others, states that Trump won, and they are up for re-election in 2018. So there's two pieces of why they would support it. One, you obviously want financial support from the banking industry, so you might be inclined to do some of the things they want, but they also want to be able to say to their voters that they reached across party lines, they did something that might help community banks, they want to be seen as bipartisan, and they don't want to be painted as, part of the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party. But what you see there is just an encapsulation of the divide in the Democratic Party right now, with the Warren wing very aggressive, very against any bank deregulation, and then some more moderate Democrats worried about their standing in the midterms, willing to come to terms with Republicans and accept some of these changes. And that'll play out throughout the 2018 midterms.
The Senate bill also rolls back rules meant to rule out racial discrimination by mortgage lenders. The Washington Post describes it, and I think many people have said over these 10 years, that the financial industry disproportionately targeted Black and Hispanic borrowers with subprime mortgages loaded with high fees and adjustable interest rates that skyrocketed after the stock market crashed in 2008. I think it's an objective fact that foreclosure rates were higher in minority communities, and the Post is describing that they were targeted for these subprime higher risk mortgages in the first place. So what measures did Dodd-Frank include to prevent that kind of racial singling out by mortgage lenders, and why are they being rolled back?
Right. Well, it included a lot more reporting requirements for every bank, essentially, that these banks had to tell the federal government who they were lending to, what criteria they were using to determine who got a mortgage loan, and that applied to both the big banks and also smaller regional and community lenders. And what this bill does is lighten up those reporting requirements and gives banks, particularly community banks and credit unions, more leeway to make mortgages however they want to and not necessarily tell the federal government all about it. So the theory that the progressives and some Democrats are pointing to is that this could give them the ability to go back to the old ways, to go back to profiling in mortgages, to not necessarily giving mortgages to minorities, or to give them mortgages that have these onerous terms that you're talking about, that have higher rates and hidden fees and all these sort of things. So we don't necessarily know that they're going to do that, because a lot of the bad mortgage practices came back to bite them, and they had a lot of lost loans. But the worry is that they now have the opportunity to do that. And they're given that opportunity because Republicans say this means more people will have access to mortgages and it'll be better for the economy. But they could do it in secret. If they don't have to report to the federal government, the fear is they'll go back to bad practices that we saw during the financial crisis.
My guest is Ben White, Politico Pro's chief economics correspondent and author of the Morning Money column, which covers the nexus of finance and public policy. We can take phone calls for him on anything like that. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's go to another story. The president tapped the CNBC host, Larry Kudlow, to be the next director of the National Economic Council. A lot of people who don't remember the Reagan years just know him as a conservative talk show host who's economics oriented. He also was the associate director of Reagan's Office of Management and Budget. So what's the Larry Kudlow thing here, and why? I mean, he's certainly from central casting, and we see Trump is remaking his cabinet again with a central casting mindset. So, it's Larry Kudlow from CNBC. But by the same token, he replaces Gary Cohn, and I think, you know, they overlap on some things on which they disagree with the president. Like, I think neither of them loves this America First tariffs regime. So what's the Larry Kudlow thing?
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, the most important part of the Larry Kudlow story is that he is also a free trader like Gary Cohn was. He doesn't like tariffs on steel or aluminum. And some people on Wall Street and in corporate America who feared that Trump would pick a like-minded protectionist for this job, meaning there would be no opposing voices in the administration on this critical trade issue, were a little bit mollified by the fact that Kudlow got the job. But it's an open question the extent to which Larry will push back against the president. Gary Cohn was really outspoken in his opposition to these tariffs and made the case to the president, this is going to do more damage to the economy than help it, and you're really not going to wind up helping the folks you want to help. Larry may do that. He may not do it. I think the main reason that Trump picked him for the job, they've been friends for a while. Larry worked on the campaign, worked on the president's tax plan, but he really likes the fact that Kudlow is good on TV, obviously had the CNBC show for years, and he says nice things about Trump on television. And as we know, president likes that. So that's kind of why he hired Larry. The extent to which Kudlow will continue to be a strong voice within the administration, pushing back on protectionism, we don't know. That's something to watch really carefully to see how that plays out.
Kudlow was recently on the WABC John Batchelor show, where he said this about tariffs.
The steel tariffs get into the NAFTA discussions because Canada is a steelmaker who will pay this tariff, and Mexico is a steelmaker that will pay this tariff. And my greatest fear, Josh, is not the steel thing, but that we will walk away from NAFTA, which I think would be a calamitously bad decision, turn business against the president, where he's gotten a lot of goodwill, and would frankly blow up the whole stock market. That's what I think.
So he's for staying in NAFTA. We don't know that that's consistent with Trump either.
Yeah, we don't. He certainly talked about getting out of NAFTA and what a terrible deal it is, and he talked about it repeatedly on the campaign trail. And these talks are going on right now between our U.S. trade rep, Robert Lighthizer, and the Mexicans and the Canadians to try to reach an agreement. And I'm sure that Larry inside the White House will say the kinds of things he said on the Bachelor show there. You know, the extent to which Trump will listen to him. I think what we're seeing now on the trade front is a president who believes in his own instincts and doesn't necessarily want to hear no on anything. And if he's unhappy with the direction that the NAFTA talks are taking, he could unilaterally pull out of it. Larry will certainly push back against that idea. I've talked to him about it multiple times, and he really is concerned that it would both tank the stock market and then lead to, you know, a kind of trade war that would be calamitous for the U.S. So he'll be in there making that case. I'm not sure that Trump will be receptive to it. He's moving in the opposite direction right now, and he does not have somebody like Cohn who would really kind of aggressively make that case. We'll see how Larry does it, but it would not surprise me greatly to see Trump ultimately pull out of NAFTA.
And we did see Kudlow start to soften his language on his own opposition to tariffs in an interview the other day. He said, you knock them in the teeth and get their attention, and then you kind of work out a deal. And I think that's what Trump has done. My hat's off to him. He really had me worried. Now I'm not. So if there's a nuance there, if we take that as an earnest nuance and not just now, you know, toting up to the president because he's being appointed, I guess it's that selective tariffs like the steel and aluminum tariffs might be a good idea as knocking them in the teeth, as he put it, and that gets the attention of the rest of the world to be fair in their trading policies with us. So I guess the what do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think you've hit on the key question here, is the extent to which Kudlow will shape his own views to please the president. I think in any of these moments where you're sort of under consideration for a West Wing job that you want, and you've been critical of the president in the past, it behooves you to nuance what you say a little bit and mollify him in certain ways on tariffs. And I think that, you know, Larry Kudlow and some others do believe that there are ways to target some of China's anti-competitive practices, dumping, intellectual property theft, all the things that we know that China does in trade that are unfair, and that there are strategic ways to rebut that. Kudlow has made the case for having a coalition of the willing on trade, our trading partners, to collectively go against China. The question is, once he's in the White House, will he continue to shift his views and kind of cozy up to Trump and say the things that he wants to hear and agree with him on everything? Or will he say, okay, your instincts on this are incorrect and wrong. Here's another way to do it, which is what Gary Cohn did. And we don't know that. We won't know it till we see it. But it's going to be hugely important as they consider sweeping tariffs on China, which could be just days away from Trump announcing those.
Since the Kudlow clip there was about Canada, as well as Mexico, we know that Trump has exempted Canada and Mexico from the steel tariffs for now, but the larger fear, as Kudlow put it, is that that's just a precursor to pulling out of NAFTA altogether, and then he will impose them, as well as many other things, on Canada and Mexico. And this gets to the Washington Post revelation this week that Trump claimed to the Prime Minister of Canada that we have a trade deficit with them without knowing whether it's true. And the U.S. Trade Representative's office says it's false, but Trump is doubling down, insisting once again that a false statement of his was true. The Washington Post has released that audio now, and I'm going to play this clip. It was from a fundraiser this week. So this was a closed door event where Trump was bragging to the crowd that he said something to Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau that he, Trump, didn't know if it was true.
Trudeau came to see me. He's a good guy, Justin. He said, no, we have no trade deficit with you. We have none. Donald, please, nice guy, good looking guy, comes in. Donald, we have no trade deficit. He's very proud because everybody else, you know, we're getting killed with them. So he's proud. I said, wrong, Justin, you do. I didn't even know. Josh, I had no idea. I just said, you're wrong. You know why? Because we're so stupid.
So, of course, the audio on that was not great. It was, you know, informally reported, recorded. But if you listen close, you get the idea that he said he claimed this thing to the Prime Minister of Canada, which the Prime Minister of Canada was much better informed about than the president, because he kept insisting back with certainty that it is not true, that Canada actually has a trade deficit with us, not the other way around. And what Trump and his spokeswoman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, have come out and said in subsequent days is, yeah, it's true if you include the right categories, like timber. Mm-hmm. So for you as an economics reporter, can you break this down for us, deconfuse our listeners, and tell us what's actually true here about trade deficits with Canada?
Yeah, I will tell you, Brian, that as an economics reporter, this stuff makes me want to tear my hair out, but it's happened so consistently, I shouldn't be surprised by it. The simple fact is that we do not have a trade deficit with Canada. We have a trade surplus when all goods and services are counted, and that's how you count trade deficits. You don't exclude some things and include others. So what Trump initially said in that recording was that he just came out and said, we have a trade deficit with you. And Trudeau said, no, you don't. And Trump said, well, I don't even know if it's true. Then he came out and reinstated that it is true, that we have a trade deficit with Canada. We don't. We have a surplus of goods and services. It's true that if you subtract out services like financial services or anything like that, they export some more hard goods to us. But I like to think of that like calling a basketball game and saying team A won if you don't consider three-point shots and free throws. I mean, it's just not the way you do it. Trade deficits and surpluses are simple things. And the fact is, I think in 2016, we had a $17 billion trade surplus with Canada. Those are simply the facts, and anything else is wrong and incorrect and designed to mislead. And that's what Trump did, and that's what Sarah Huckabee Sanders did yesterday, asserting that we do have a trade deficit with Canada if you just consider goods. Well, you don't just consider goods. So they're lying, they're obfuscating, and you know, it's what Trump wants to be true. This is a situation where he feels like we have a trade deficit with everyone, including Canada, so it must be true, even though by any objective measure, it is false.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Ben White, Politico Pro's chief economics correspondent, as we talk about some of the Trump-related economic policy news this week. And we have some interesting callers standing by. Here's Jim in Easton, Pennsylvania, who I think is going to support the rolling back of Dodd-Frank. Jim, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
So my question is will that new financial regulation rolling back, will it ease the restrictions on lending as far as the ability to repay goes, specifically the debt-to-income ratio requirement of 43% or less?
Because do you feel you own, I see you told her a screener, you own a rental building and you can't get a loan, and you feel it's because of Dodd-Frank. So it's that would be interesting for our listeners to hear. How do you feel that Dodd-Frank is unnecessarily onerous on you as, I guess, a landlord?
So the way it works is that when you have rental properties, it skews your debt-to-income ratio high if you have mortgages on those properties. Even if you're making a profit on the rental properties, if, you know, what you're taking in is, like, if the debt to the income is 75%, you have to average that into the rest of your debt-to-income ratio. So it can skew your debt-to-income ratio up, even though it adds to your income, which is kind of a mathematical anomaly.
And so Dodd-Frank made more strict the debt-to-income ratios?
Yeah, it legislated that you have to have a debt-to-income ratio of 43% or less in order to get credit.
So, Ben White, is this an issue you're familiar with? And this is certainly one of the complaints that I've heard, frankly, from Larry Kudlow on his show, among many others, is that Dodd-Frank not only regulates the banks and tries to protect the country from another too-big-to-fail collapse with all those ramifications, but the side effect is that it's harder for people who should qualify for loans to get loans, and that tamps down the economy as well as hurts those individuals.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to exactly the language in this bill currently that speaks to debt-to-income ratios, and it would depend on who your lender is in this instance, because some banks are getting relief from these provisions and some banks aren't. But if you are with a smaller lender or a credit union or somebody other than one of the giant banks, my belief is that it would address some of those requirements, because the whole theory behind it is to address this very question. Are the regulations under Dodd-Frank, particularly on debt-to-income ratio and for mortgages and other products, are they too onerous, and are they holding back what would be and should be legitimate economic activity? So that's the theory and the goal of this legislation, and I think it would include it for you if your lender is not, you know, J.P. Morgan or Citigroup or Bank of America. I don't think those banks are getting much relief at all. But some of the smaller lenders who theoretically pose less risk to the global economy are getting relief. So maybe if you're with one of the big lenders, you might want to think about switching to another one who should be getting some relief under this bill.
That's pretty interesting. That indicates, if I heard you right, that it would be easier for a business to get a loan now from a smaller community bank than from one of the big guys.
That's my understanding, and I think that's the theory behind this, is that the targeted relief is for smaller lenders that are closer to their communities and the people they're lending to, and might have a better understanding of who they are and what their financial situation is, and to get those folks to be able to give more loans and not have some of these arbitrary requirements, whereas that wouldn't apply to the giant banks who are lending to huge corporations, for the most part, and less so to small business.
But also because if a community bank goes down because it's made bad loans, it isn't
Precisely.
All the taxpayers' problem.
So. Exactly. And you could have some of those fail, and it wouldn't be like J.P. Morgan collapsing.
Gene exactly in Westchester, right. You're on WNYC. Hi, Gene.
Oh, hi. I have a question. This kind of goes back a little bit in history. You know, Trump has been able to move markets quite easily by making different pronouncements. If you recall, when he was a president-elect, he made a comment about Boeing, and the Boeing stock, dropped precipitously immediately and then came back a little bit later. But, he gets out there on Twitter and he makes these economic pronouncements. And I'm curious, is there anybody looking at people on the inside, either in the White House, in his circle, or his company, that might have inside information about when he is about to make these kind of...
You're asking if he's making statements or even endorsing policies to move markets to benefit himself. Is that your question?
Well, I think he's doing it, in terms of, let's say, policy, but there are people on the inside who know that he's going to be doing it, and are they profiting mm-hmm. from advance notice that he's going to make a public statement.
Gene, thank you very much. I would recommend to you our WNYC podcast, Trump Inc., with Andrew Bernstein and Ilya Marritz, which focuses like a laser beam on the intersection of Trump's financial interests and public policy. But can you give him a quick answer, Ben, as we're almost out of time?
Yeah, I would say no. I'm not aware of any investigations into Trump's tweets being known in advance by members inside the administration. I mean, the fact is that pretty much people in the West Wing and in the rest of the administration have no idea what Trump's going to tweet, when he's going to tweet it. If they did, they'd probably be a lot happier. This is something certainly the SEC would look at if they saw unusual trading activity, say in a Boeing stock or in pharmaceutical stocks around the time when Trump was going after them, and that would trigger investigations by the SEC. So far, we haven't seen anything like that, but I do imagine if it were to occur, you would get investigations into it. But the fact of the matter is, Trump tweets what he wants, when he wants, and he doesn't really tell anybody about it beforehand.
And we just have under a minute left, but when I was prepping for this conversation, I came across the article in Crane's New York Business that steel prices for construction sites in New York City, so this would have implications for housing costs here in the city, are already going up in anticipation of the steel tariffs. I don't expect you to necessarily know about this, but here's a potential local impact in the way that a projected policy does move markets after Trump just says something. Is this something you're familiar with?
It is, and it's exactly what you would expect to see both in the local New York market and around the country. And it's why people like Gary Cohn warn against these kind of tariffs on steel and aluminum, because what you do is perhaps protect a few thousand jobs in Pennsylvania in the steel industry, but you damage builders and contractors and automobile makers and washing machine makers. Anybody who uses aluminum steel and buys it on a global marketplace pays more now, and it's going to impact New York projects, and it's going to impact similar projects across the country. It's the whole theory of why tariffs are not a great idea and why trade wars wind up hurting everyone and helping, you know, very few people.
Ben White, Politico Pro's chief economics correspondent and author of their Morning Money column, which covers the intersection of finance and public policy. Thank you so much for your clarity. We appreciate it.
It was my great pleasure. Thank you.